that through reintroducing this choice about what money is and how it functions in our world is really powerful. Because, you know, when I say I'm a Bitcoiner or you're a Bitcoiner, it's not just a signal that this is the money that we want to use, but it's also that we want to participate in a system of fairness, that we want to utilize a money that has no basis or backing that is tethered to violence or the state or how that functions.
What's going on, everyone? I'm John Chenot, and welcome to episode 3 of the Bitcoin Path podcast. This is a show where we have deep conversations about Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, focusing in on how this new magic internet money is changing the world and changing ourselves at the same time. I'm thrilled to have Eric Kaysen on the pod today. Eric is a crypto anarchist, a farmer, an iconoclast. He is obsessed with Bitcoin and has been working in the industry since 2013. Eric has a deep understanding of cryptography technology and brings a unique perspective with his research in philosophy, political theory, and economics. You can read more of Eric's articles on his Medium page at medium.com/@Eric Kaysen. You can follow him on Twitter @@Eric Kaysen. I had a blast talking to Eric. I really hope you enjoy listening in. Before we dive into this conversation, I want to take a moment to shill an online event that's coming up soon. An essential part of anyone's Bitcoin journey is putting in the mental work to understand it from first principles. Depending on your background, this process can take weeks, months, or even years without any kind of guide. With Bitcoin's inevitable price increase over time, the opportunity cost for vacillating over this is staggering. That's why I'm hosting an intensive educational event. I'm gathering 6 of the best educators in the Bitcoin community for an immersive online conference, December 12th and the 13th, and I'm calling it an interactive deep dive. I'm trying to say Bitcoin as many times as possible, so you know it's only about Bitcoin. There will be no shitcoin, shilling, or anything like that. The speakers are Robert Breedlove, Max Hillebrand, Eric Kaysen, John Vallis, Dan Held, and Gigi. There are 15 interactive seats. For those of you who want to engage with the speakers on a more personal level and raise your own questions and comments with each speaker after their talk. Then we have 100 observer seats for those who want to sit in on the conference and watch all the training and the conversations unfold. If you are interested in joining, you can check out more information at interactivedeepdive.com or go to our events page at thebitcoinpath.com. I hope to see you there. And with that, let's get into my conversation with Eric Kaysen. Eric, welcome to the show, man. Thanks for coming on. We can just give a brief introduction to yourself, your background, and kind of what you've been involved with for the past few years. You mentioned that you were at Coinbase. I almost said Coinbase. Coinbase for a little while.
Yeah.
Is that kind of your first vocational involvement with Bitcoin?
That was my first vocational involvement with it. I'd gotten interested in it about a year earlier, kind of late 2011, 2012. I started looking at it, was curious about it. And then I was working at a temp job at a bank for a while. And that's kind of when I really got into it, because I saw the insides of a bank and kind of how terrible it was. So in 2013, really during kind of like the first wave of Coinbase's support hiring, I got into it. And from 2013 to 2017, I did like a number of support roles. And it ended with me in a managerial role, had a large team of support people. But eventually, like, I stepped away from Coinbase just because of some of the choices they made about, you know, supporting altcoins and that kind of stuff. And also just for me personally, I needed some time out. Yeah, and after that, I just kind of started writing about a lot of the things that I had learned and my own beliefs and my understandings of how Bitcoin cryptography operated. And yeah, and today, like that's kind of where I'm at and what I do. I've been talking with kind of several different companies about maybe joining them in some capacity, but I'm pretty free to do what I want as I please at this point. So
that's always a good place to be. I can really tell from just going through some of your writings that the topic of Bitcoin and cryptography, your understanding of political theory, this isn't something that you just kind of like, it's not necessarily just a hobby of yours. This is something that you have thought about very intensely, like over the course of the last, the last few years.
I'd say it's pretty much been my thought obsession for close to the last decade. And that's really kind of why I got into it. It busted a lot of kind of my political theory and ideas. Because I approached this from like a far left position initially. And as I got deeper and deeper into Bitcoin, it challenged a lot of my political beliefs. And as those challenges came up, I started to dig deeper and deeper into them. Because my education, I graduated from San Francisco State University. I had a dual degree in both in 20th century European history and also another degree in international relations. And so those two really kind of helped give me a great political outlook to approach Bitcoin. And as I sort of started to unwind it more and more, I sort of developed, I don't know if you'd call it my own political theory, but I'd say I've adapted the political theory of, some intellectual giants such as George Lambigan and Carl Schmitt to fit pretty well within the confines of like what I believe both cryptography and Bitcoin to be.
Right. We just cut out. I lost the last like two sentences of what you said. Can you hear me?
I was just saying that, essentially a lot of my political theory has tried to adapt the works of Carl Schmitt and Giorgio Ambigan, along with a whole slew of other characters, because, these are brilliant men that have thought about this topic pretty intensely so far. So it's been very helpful having their work aid me in kind of extending this into, I guess, I'm not really sure what you'd call this, crypto theory or something, but it's been nice that, I felt like a crazy person for a long time, and now people are actually starting to pay attention and be like, hey, you're not as crazy as we once thought.
And I kind of feel this way too sometimes when, I'm walking around, I live in Chicago, and I'll be walking the streets and I'll be spending so much time thinking about, I'll read a book like Creature from Jekyll Island and get this massive awakening to what is really going on beneath the surface of so many of the day-to-day things that we take for granted. And I'll be walking around like no one has any clue. It feels almost like we're either I'm crazy or they're crazy, or like there's no way to like reconcile it. But I feel like right now things are changing a little bit to the point where there's a little more openness, at least to like people are seeing things that are going wrong and wondering, well, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, I mean the face of this whole apparatus is kind of, I don't want to say ripped off, but like it's definitely showing itself in ways it hasn't before. And like I'm like in this place now where I get that like I'm not crazy, that the rest of the world's crazy, and I've been here long enough that I get that. And one of the things that's been so reassuring for me is having watched the price change and, accumulate greater and greater amounts of wealth from, back in the hundreds of dollars now where we're at today. If the fact that the smartest guys in the room to say are laughing off Bitcoin and saying this thing's impossible or that it can't work, and that not only were they wrong, but like they were wrong by orders of magnitude over and over repeatedly up till today, they're so wrong it's not even funny. I feel sorry for them genuinely that like you're in charge of hundreds of millions of dollars that you're gonna eviscerate, because when you look at a system that you can't control like Bitcoin, you see it as a form of danger as opposed to a form of a saving power. And I really hope that more people are going to entertain the notion of, why should I trust that this banking system that says, you know, whether it be a financial advisor that tells me that my 401k will go up and be protected, or if it is a stockbroker that's telling me that this is the next big tech stop, or if it's the bank saying, hey, we're going to issue more bonds to, you know, make sure that things can be stabilized. Why should you actually trust them? Like, what makes their system have inherent trust inside of it and other systems to not have that? And I think that these sort of questions are the most important and potent aspect to actually arriving at sincerely logical conclusions of what system should we trust? Like, what actually is crazy? You know, like, is an internet money that can operate globally and is secured by electricity crazy? Or is trusting a huge banking system that we know and understand how deeply corrupt it is, you know? And it's an open question, because I think there's plenty of people that will still say the banks are safer. And great, like, that's where you should put your money.
Right. I don't feel like you're that person, are you, Eric?
No, I'm I put all of my crazy pills into the basket long ago. Or better, I should say, I threw all my crazy pills away, because, you know, and I think it's an important thing, is that the idea of risk subjectivity is, like, I know and understand, like, this world's not guaranteed and promised to us, you know, like, a giant rock can fall out of the sky and kill you tomorrow. And we have this entire banking and financial system that's set up upon these false notions of the safety and security it can provide you, and it's just not true. You know, if we look at the 400 year of fiat history, of fiat money's history in the West, we can see that every single fiat money that's ever existed has failed. And if it hasn't failed, it's been inflated 99.9%, such as the pound. You know, and there's this huge concourse of history.
Can you just break down a little bit of, like, what we mean by fiat money?
Fiat money, first of all, actually coming from the Latin terminology, fiat, which means... it was part of a Roman decree of, like, let it be done. It was a law that was declared and was implemented immediately because it was found to be of the authority of law. And that's actually what the money is as well, is it is of the authority of law. You know, a dollar is worth a dollar, not because the paper itself is inherently worth a dollar. It's because, or even for the fact that we can transact for a dollar worth of goods with it. It's actually worth a dollar because it has been made legal tender, and that's the only legal tender in the United States. You know, when you accept Bitcoin, that's actually seen under the eyes of the law as being a kind of barter or a commodity trade, if you will. And so right. Fiat money, this idea for a government just saying, hey, here's new money to exist, this creates some really extreme problems, which I hope most people are aware of since coronavirus has came out into the world, that part of this quote-unquote stimulus package where everybody got their $1,200 or whatever, while it's great that most people got that $1,200, companies like Boeing got $25 billion, you know, and there's very few strings attached to that. And the big problem is if we're all sharing one pie of money, if a second pie shows up and we don't get any of that pie, you know, we actually have less pie in total compared to what's available. And John Maynard Keynes, after interviewing Lenin, there's this great quote from him where he talks about how inflation is like this way that you can very secretly and guilefully steal from people in a way that they can't really notice or understand. And that's kind of where we're at right now. You know, it's pretty clear also there's going to be another spending bill where more money is created. And it really has to be a question of, you know, where is this going to stop? Why should it stop? You know, like it seems to be very politically popular to give people money, which is understandable. But we need to ask ourselves, what are the consequences of that on the back end?
Right. I want to back up a little bit and just kind of assess the situation. Like, what to you are the primary underlying, like, if we can nail down what are the main problems with society? Is it inflation? Is it a combination of different things? I actually heard I think it was Guy Swan say something along these lines, like we're seeing a breakdown of trust in current institutions, that hold a lot of control and a lot of power right now. Is that part of the fundamental shift going on?
I think that does nail it down really well, because if we use this idea of trust specifically around institutions, and we can kind of prism it, we'll actually say that that's breaking down a number of ways. You know, like let's trust in the educational establishment. Well, you know, like how often do you learn about the genocides that American troops conducted, or that, you know, American troops have bombed, you know, U.S. soil before, after World War II, you know? So that trust is lacking. You trust the bank that they're not going to work with criminals, and you see their efforts through stuff like KYC legislation. But you don't actually hear about how KYC legislation, while 99.9% of people that do KYC aren't committing a crime, they still have to hold the burden of it. Yet the bank is actually helping, you know, Mexican drug cartels that are responsible for horrific amounts of violence. They're actually laundering billions of dollars for them pretty openly and freely. And like this pattern goes on and on. It goes on to money, it goes on to banking, goes on to education, goes on to pretty much every large institution, journalism, you know. And I think a lot of these are affects of the internet, you know, that there is this very new and radical form of communication that changes the channels of trust in a way that we haven't fully understood. And Bitcoin is part of the consequence of that. You know, I think more than anything else, Satoshi Nakamoto in the Bitcoin white paper points out that this is all about trust, as opposed to it being about trying to create a new form of money or about trying to mint some new kind of coin. He really focuses on the trust aspect and how that isn't working in the internet age, and how Bitcoin is a solution for that.
Yeah, there really is this element of heightened connectivity creating faster and faster development in interpersonal communication, and like in warring factions where you have these competing ideologies who, back in the day, you would maybe like write a newspaper article espousing some like radical political belief, and then the opposing faction would muster up their own intellectual rigor to create another article, and communication would bounce back and forth in this like kind of slower fashion. Whereas now there's this heightened connectivity and people are able to interact and polarize themselves so quickly. And in addition to that, they're able to research a lot more. People are able to see more of what's going on with like police brutality, or get evidence of state surveillance through things like WikiLeaks and with Edward Snowden. All of these things seem to be piling up causes. And I've felt this at certain times, and I know a lot of people are feeling this, like a real emotional anxiety about what is going on and feeling that there's no firm footing. And that's where Bitcoin really comes in for me, as I've thought through this stuff, is it's providing this stable informational transactional network that that we can rely on in this hyper connected world.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think well, first, you know, to speak to, you know, we just had the election. We still don't know what the outcome is. There's clear, palpable tension around that. In addition to kind of all of the information warfare that's going on against people to try to make them understand one view or another, have one belief or another. And this has caused a real palpable sense of anxiety for people. And it's the lack of certainty around really the principles of anything. And to me, that's also where Bitcoin steps in, is that it is this kind of guarantee and assurance that is not found in any institution anywhere, you know. And perhaps once there was an assurance that we could have like that in our political establishment, but with what modernity has left us with, it's no longer available. And to me, Bitcoin is just the first of hopefully many iterations of different methods that we will have to reclaim our power, you know. And I think we're already starting to see some evidence of that, but Bitcoin is definitely the most powerful mode of that, you know. And from my time working in the banking system, you know, I found it very scary to understand that these notions that we've been told about rights that we have, about there needing to be a warrant for those sort of things, like these are all sort of these romantic fictions that we've been told, you know. I know that on the banking back end, anyone who has admin access can really look at whatever they want. They can cut off what bank accounts they want, and they could, all that stuff can be done without a warrant, you know. I think it was back starting in 2014, we saw something called Operation Choke Point, which was about like undesirable businesses, maybe like a porn website or a sex toy shop or something like that. They were getting cut off from banking services, not because they had done anything wrong or illegal, but just because they were the bad other people that they didn't want.
Right.
And like that's part of the world that we're going to go into, is that, you know, the bad people, whomever they choose to label that with, these are the people that will get their banking services cut off. They will be surveilled extra amounts from the police. They will have people show up at their door in the middle of the night and say, you need to think about what you're doing and leave. And, you know, the right word for it is fascism, you know. And it's very scary because, you know, we've used this as a boogeyman in the same way that we've used, you know, words like communism to scare people for a long time. But this is sincerely what fascism looks like. It is using fear and terror and a surveillance state in order to make sure that people comply and behave in a way that they need to. You know, what the version of social media that we have today is the Stasi's wet dream. Like, they would have given anything to have been able to have this kind of data and information on people. And I think as we go into the second decade of this century, we're going to see that power abused and used more frequently and egregiously than we've ever had before. And that's one of the reasons that I think Bitcoin is so important, is that it operates outside of this legal system of assured rights that we purportedly have. Because when I have my Bitcoin encrypted, utilizing the protocol correctly, there's no way to take that from me. You can beat me with a pipe wrench. You can rip my fingers off. Frank, truth is with stuff in a multi-signature address, it's not going to get moved no matter what. And I think we're going to see some pretty interesting confrontations, not just with the state, but with criminals and other ne'er-do-wellers on a whole, as we sort of go into, you know, what I see as a darker time in our history. I hope I'm wrong about these things. Being a student of history, I have to entertain it.
Yeah. Well, what is it that people say? Like, one of the biggest mistakes that people make is thinking that the future is going to be just like the present or just like the recent past, whereas things can change very quickly. And that kind of leads me to one of the things I wanted to dig into about your article, The Political Theology of Bitcoin. One of the things that you point out is the action of the state and the so-called temporary measures actually being the reality of their power. Is that kind of like getting to the basis of what you're talking about? I can't remember the exact wording.
That's part of it. So political theology, it's actually extracted from, I have a Schmidt book on my shelf that's about this. It's from a book that he has titled Political Theology, where he really digs in to try to observe, like, what is the political truly? And for Schmidt, he comes to the conclusion that what the political actually is the sovereign's ability to make and choose on the decision of the exception. And so any point in time that...
the exception.
Yeah, any time that the political apparatus gets to say, hey, like, we're in a state of emergency because things are at such an exceptional nature. You know, we're going to go outside and beyond the law at this point in time because of the exceptional nature of this thing. That's actually the root of how, like, they can always step past what the boundaries of the law are. And that's exactly what we saw, you know, with the Patriot Act in 9/11, with what Snowden was exposing, with what the NSA was spying on. And it's essentially the way that And this isn't just unique to the American form of governance. Like this is about how any kind of liberal democratic institution operates, is that there is always this ability for an emergency decree to be used in order to essentially subsume the entirety of the state. And this is what we also saw in Nazi Germany in 1933, you know, after the Reichstag had been purportedly set on fire by the evil communists. You know, the hero Hitler was able to say, I declare an emergency that gives me full power and purview over the government, which we kind of know how that ended 12 years later. And so, like, I, in the political theology of Bitcoin, I was trying to essentially point out that we need to understand that this capacity and ability for the state to declare a state of emergency, it's not like some far out thing that isn't here. Like we've been living in it for the past two decades, and it looks like constant surveillance and this ability to not just deprive people of habeas corpus, but to bend the laws in all of these modes and ways that are much more subservient for the government than it is for other people. You know, so much so to the extent that like we have this real lack of understanding that, you know, the Constitution in its entirety as a document is made for the protection of American individual people and the limiting of governmental power on a whole in its capacity. Whereas it's inverted right. itself in such a way that it's about trying to restrict and contain their power in several ways, which in my opinion goes to show the very real and naked nature of it, is that governance have essentially said that they have a right to unlimited power in emergency situations in order for them to ensure the continuation of their state of affairs, as opposed to, right. you know, you have unlimited rights and protection through the freedom of your speech, to your right to own, bear arms, whatever else it may be. And that inversion is the troubling part that we really need to address, and is what, in my opinion, cryptography fundamentally breaks. Because no longer are we within a theater of politics, rights, or approval, but about the actual mathematical functions of how cryptography itself operates.
Right. Yeah. So I'd love to dig into that, because what fascinates me about it is it completely changes the conversation from, you know, what these governing authorities have a right to do, whether it's an emergency or not. And it completely blows all of that out of the water and just comes down to math. Like, it's completely impossible for them to do something where it's like there's a layer of protection, or there can be a layer of protection if people utilize it, of their, at the very least, of information. How does that work? Why is that the case? And then maybe elaborate a little on that.
Sure. Well, the reason for why it exists is, if you take a Bitcoin private key, you know, that is this long ass, 54 hex decimal key that you have, you know, which is essentially randomized uppercase and lowercase letters and numbers. And with that being such a long password, if you will, in trying to access your Bitcoin, if you were trying to like randomly guess that, that's like trying to randomly guess where an atom is in the universe. So like you're trying to guess a very, very, very specific number. And so what's important about, you know, trying to guess something so complex is that if you took the most powerful supercomputer that you could possibly imagine, if you took all of the time that was available in the universe, and you took all of the heat entropy of the sun, you still wouldn't have enough energy to randomly guess this thing. And so what we saw with the development of cryptography after World War II and the Enigma machine, and its increasing development all the way up until, you know, really kind of at the turn of the 21st century, we started to get such complex mathematical algorithms that was creating cryptography that we could confidently say that this stuff couldn't actually get cracked. And this opened up, in my opinion, a totally new territory where we could start actually talking about cryptography that was so exceptional that it was impossible to break. And what's even more exciting is now we're getting more kind of complicated applications of this. So if you're using a multi-signature scheme, not only do you need to get my private key, but you need to get the second key signers so that it kind of essentially works like nuclear launch keys. So this provides really powerful protections to say, like let's say I have 100 Bitcoin that I keep secure and the state comes and arrests me because I committed some crime that they didn't like. Well, in normal circumstances, your bank accounts are shut down. Like, there's a whole slew of administrative actions that happen that make my defense much more difficult, frankly. You know, like, if your bank accounts are shut down and seized, you now have a harder time hiring a lawyer, blah, blah, blah. Whereas with a multi-signature scheme, even if I've been captured, I could have my second on my multi-signature scheme still be able to access my Bitcoin, hire me a lawyer, do all that kind of stuff. And so it becomes this really important check on both economic and political power because, you know, the truth is that even if you're not committing a crime or doing something wrong, you can still get captured in this thing and become a victim of it. And I think that that's really important is that instead of people being like, hey, I'm not a criminal. I have nothing to hide. What do I have to worry about?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was going to ask.
First of all, everybody has something to hide in this day and age. You know, I'm sorry. Like, if you sincerely believe that you don't have kinks or opinions or secrets or anything that needs to be protected, then you're probably the most boring person on the planet, or you're lying. One of the two. I'm going to take the latter. You know, and the second one is when it comes to just the general protection, you're not immune to the dragnet. You know, and I think any black person in Chicago who has walked down the street in a nice white neighborhood could tell you that. And that's really important because I also think that part of the general racism and terror that this system is about is making sure that when people do approach this apparatus that wants to punish them, there's all of these secondary ways that it's not even about being found guilty. It's about being accused. And so I think making sure that you have this backup plan for if you do get arrested, you know, with all the protests going on is a great example. You can just get snatched up off the street and they say that, you know, you're trying to burn something out. Well, now what are you going to do if they've shut down your bank accounts, if you don't have any access to something? And so like that was kind of a circuitous route to get here. But, you know, that's one of the reasons why I feel strongly everybody should have some amount of Bitcoin, not because they will even necessarily need it, but because if you do find yourself in a position where you are the enemy of the state and they are trying to take you out, how are you going to defend yourself in any meaningful way if all of your economic means have been deprived from you?
Right. So that whole aspect, of security and of the ability to control your own value, your own wealth, is one aspect of Bitcoin that is so huge and has massive implications. Another aspect to it is this idea of value and the scarcity aspect of it, right? Where what we were talking about earlier, you were pointing out how the Fed printed, was it $6 trillion in this most recent stimulus, and we'll probably print the general monetary supply. Maybe can you talk about the specific properties of Bitcoin that make it resistant to that type of thing? I know still, even though there's so much great information out there, I'll still talk to people about Bitcoin and be like, well, and they'll say, well, can't they just make more of it? Like, isn't it just on the internet?
Yeah, so this is like some of the most exciting stuff is no. So first of all, the actual supply schedule and the way that new Bitcoins can get created is fixed and baked in the code in such a way that it can never ever change. And that's really important, because even if people are like, well, like, can't you just create a new one? Yeah, you have. And like, people have done that with Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin Gold and Bitcoin Diamond. Turns out that a secondary knockoff of something is just a secondary knockoff of something. And so then people go, well, okay, so like, how is this all actually happening? And essentially what's going on in the Bitcoin network is people are looking, they're doing what's called Bitcoin mining. Bitcoin mining is essentially using high-powered computer chips that have been specifically engineered to try to look for Bitcoins in this mining process, where every 10 minutes, when you're searching for this very specific number that is created, if you can find that, you win the prize of how the supply schedule of Bitcoin is created in conjunction with the transactions that happen. To me, the most important process of understanding this is the actual amount of energetical electrical output that's put into the network is part of what's securing it. And so today, I think Bitcoin consumes a massive amount of electricity. It's something like the equivalent of the entirety of like what it takes to power the country of Switzerland. So the reason that this is important is that, so let's say governments are unhappy that Bitcoin's doing really well, and they're like, let's destroy this thing. We don't want it around on the earth anymore. First, what they have to do is they have to buy something like $20 million worth, or maybe it's $20 billion, I can't remember, I haven't read it in a while, of this very specific kind of expensive hardware that's used to mine Bitcoin. Now they need to get all the energetic equivalent of the amount of energy of Switzerland. And now they need to point all of this at the Bitcoin network, trying to intentionally attack it in order to reverse transactions. So we've done all of this and gotten to the place where they can actually do that. Even at this point in time, they have to continue to spend that energy to roll back block after block. And they have to continue to spend that amount of energy. And this is also assuming that participants in the Bitcoin network aren't going to recognize this malicious behavior, figure out who the actor is, slice out that node of the network, and then repatch saying, don't recognize this thing anymore. So in other words, it's engineered in such a way that very, very specifically trying to create more Bitcoins because of the way the supply is baked into the schedule. And if you want to reverse transactions or try to change how it's been operated, you have to spend this very, very large amount of electrical energy and computational hardware that at this point, it's really kind of unachievable. Maybe you could have done it back in like 2013 or something, but today it's pretty much impossible.
Right.
I'm not sure if I nailed that. There are other people who explain the mechanics of Bitcoin mining. I think the important thing for the layman to know is that, you can trust me on this. You probably shouldn't go and read up more on it if it interests you. But essentially, you need to have like more energy than is even comprehensibly available in order to try to augment the Bitcoin network in such a way that you can steal coins or change the total supply.
Right. And so on top of that, we have this network that is so secure that there's very clear information that's locked into this thing, and you can own or control a specific part of it, mm-hmm. right? And that's another aspect that I think some people don't really get their heads around, because it's a totally different way of looking at money. We're so used to using money in a way where we trust other people, we trust these institutions like banks to take care of it for us. And even with cash, we try not to have too much cash on us in case it gets stolen. So there's this added layer of personal responsibility to owning Bitcoin. Can you maybe describe the importance of this? Like, I'm sure having been involved for so long, you have some horror stories or like scary type things.
From my time at Coinbase, you know, like I encountered kind of every kind of stupid that came through the door. And sadly, like this involved losing lots of money. So a great example is on the Bitcoin network, there's also the utilization of what's called Tether, which is essentially a peg to US dollar amounts. And actually, this is kind of a good way to describe the information, because essentially what's going on in the Tether network is they're taking tiny little fragments of Bitcoin and they're essentially like writing on top of that Bitcoin, like, here, this is worth $10,000 USD. And they like send that to a Tether account, and Tether's like, oh, okay, it's it's $10,000 worth of USD. Problem is when you take this same amount and you send it to the Bitcoin network, it's like, okay, you just sent me, 900 satoshis or whatever, some tiny, tiny little amount of Bitcoin. And we would have people send this amount to Coinbase, and they'd be like, where's my $10,000 a tether?
Oh my God.
And you're like, bro, you just flung that shit out into space. And this is kind of the fun part. It's like, now they start like breaking down. They're like, no, like, oh, like you need to get this. This is your fault. And you're like, no, dude, like you fucked up, man. And it's important and it's unfortunate, you know, like a great example from my own life is when the Bitcoin network split for the first time into the Bitcoin network and the Bitcoin Cash network. I mistakenly sent some money to a Bitcoin Cash only network. And I remember that moment of being like, I finally got myself like that. And that's also a good lesson for, you know, if you're going to be sending $10,000 somewhere, maybe you want to send $15 first. Just a suggestion, just to check on it, you know, but personal responsibility absolutely is a huge part of, in my opinion, what Bitcoin's really about, because we're saying, look, we don't even want the banks anymore. We don't want anything to do with them. We don't think that they have a right or a responsibility or that they should be trusted with people's money. And we don't think they should exist as an institution. And by being able to own and secure your Bitcoin on your own, you do take on that additional responsibility of that you must know and understand how to use your private keys. And it is a scary process. And that's one of the reasons, you know, why there are these fun little devices like Trezors and Ledgers that are hardware wallets. So even if I have a nasty Windows machine that I've loaded up with all kinds of porn and viruses and all sorts of weird things, I can still secure my Bitcoin using a hardware wallet in a way that makes sure that my private key is never actually accessed by my computer directly. And that's a really great barrier that a lot of people need. You know, and I'd say anybody that wants to own a significant amount of Bitcoin, whatever that means for you, it's pretty wise to have at least a hardware wallet. And, you know, if you're somebody that's securing several Bitcoin, I say, you know, take it a step further. Check out different multi-sig methods that you would like to use, and you should really consider that, you know. And in my opinion, multi-sig is a pretty advanced thing for individuals to do, but it's also like the conclusion of the Bitcoin journey, because like once you have a multi-sig wallet set up in a secured fashion that you know and understand is recoverable from multiple geographical locations, that's the place that you can finally say my money's secure. Even if I get hit by a bus, somebody can secure it. Even if, you know, I live in California, and where we've been having wildfires everywhere, even if a big wildfire sweeps through my town, destroys everything I've ever had, I can still recover my wealth, you know, and that's really important. And one of the cool things is Bitcoin's still in its really early development. And so in this way that it secures information, there's hope that in the future that, you know, like maybe I can also recover from utilizing my Bitcoin multi-sig, the ability to store data in a secured way that can have me recover that as well. I'm not sure of any projects doing that right now, but there's definitely a capacity with there's some newer developments in Bitcoin coming down the pipeline that are going to enable kind of more robust scripting functions such as discrete log contracts and other things that may come out in the near future.
Awesome. And is that kind of where Taproot will help things as well?
Yeah, that is part of Taproot and kind of how that whole process is going to work with Schnorr signatures as well. Schnorr signatures are these really cool things to where essentially extra information can be tucked in a Bitcoin transaction in a way that you can't actually tell it apart from other Bitcoin transactions. So it just looks like noise in the network, which is pretty essential for a future where, you know, maybe you do want to secure your Bitcoin in a more specialized way that has something called a time lock contract, where the only way you can move the Bitcoin is in, you know, a year from now or something like that.
It's fascinating. You know, I personally have just come through this in a whirlwind. Like, I knew about Bitcoin fairly early on. You know, I heard about it. I was involved in some libertarian type podcasts and anarcho-capitalist stuff, just kind of learning alternate ways of you know, looking at the world and what's going on. And but only in the past year did I really, after reading Saif Dean's book, The Bitcoin Standard, that's when it really sunk in, and I was like, holy shit, this is a massive change that's happening that I need to spend as much time as possible now trying to understand this, because that's going to pay off in huge dividends in the future if I, if what this this guy is saying is true. It's been amazing. It's been so such a fun journey, but coming into it with all of the free information that's out there, all of the amazing podcasts and the books even, I would find myself listening to these conversations, and then half of the words sometimes I don't understand, especially when we're getting into more of the technical programming conversations. But what I found was the more I listened to it, the more, it's like learning a language, I guess, like the more things kind of like solidified and just made sense.
Yeah, it's hard and it's intimidating, you know, like
100%.
I'm not a programmer or anything. Like my background, I've done a lot of stuff with computers and I feel very comfortable with them. You know, like I've built some websites, but you know, like I'm not a capable programmer. But actually kind of my approach to philosophy is probably better explaining this is, you know, like reading Heidegger, he like uses all kinds of confusing and fucked up language that's like really intimidating. And I think it's really important to just essentially mark it and say, I'm going to look up what that word is or find out more about it and keep reading. If you keep encountering it, say, you know what, I'm just going to pause this here, look up what this taproot thing is. Okay, cool. Like this is about this extension that's going to get merged into Bitcoin and it's going to expand its capacities in different ways. And you'll find eventually you start getting more scaffolding. But I think, and also like, I'm really excited that you had like that moment that, you know, like I've talked to hundreds of people involved in this and I always love learning about like that moment where they learn about it. You know, I call it like it's like the moment that they start tripping, you know, like they like took the drug at that point and they're like, whoa, like I'm like coming into this space. And it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
and it's really important because like, I think the taste of that is what offers the intellectual capacity to want to understand it. You know, and particularly for people from non-technical, non-monetary, non-economic backgrounds, there's so much going on that's difficult to ingest. And I think that hopefully my enthusiasm to others will be enough to get people through it, because once you start to see it, you know, like I'm probably one of the more extreme individuals in the Bitcoin community, but like I literally believe that Bitcoin is messianic for the way that like it opens people up to this hope. And that's like a really loaded word, I get, but I think in the kind of darkness that we're in, the promise that Bitcoin has to create a new monetary standard that's globally fair and assured in a way that that random violence can't just extract wealth from people really excites me, you know, because I came from an anarcho-communist position before where I really believed that we needed to fight the state and take this thing out in order to make a meaningful existence. And that was always kind of this pedantic fantasy that couldn't get off the ground. Whereas with Bitcoin, I feel like there is a real powerful methodology to make a choice to fight back against the state and the general crimes that we're seeing. And also like, it's a great way to actually like build a wealthy, powerful portfolio in a way that I know isn't going to be debauched at some way in the future, or is going to get wrecked because, you know, there's some black swan event like the coronavirus, which is much more of a white swan event, but irregardless, it still managed to ravish the economy in a way that nobody foresaw a year ago.
Yeah, there is this aspect where that I'd love to touch on. You know, you mentioned Bitcoin being messianic. You know, there's so many analogies. Have you ever read any of Jordan Peterson's work, like Maps of Meaning? Okay. One of the things that he talks about that in his book Maps of Meaning, and I'm going to try to summarize it the best possible, but he talks about Jesus being, and the message, the gospel, the message of Christ, essentially coming down to bringing the agency of control to to the individual, where there was no longer any barrier between God and man, the individual. There was looking in the context of Jewish history up to that point, you know, there was heavy concentration in these institutionalized temple structures and different, you know, varying levels of religious power. And what Jesus was doing was bringing the Logos to the individual person and his disciples. You know, there's so much around Christianity itself, but there's this central aspect to Jesus' teaching and what actually happened as a result. So it is, I don't think it's too absurd to think that another change of that magnitude is possible with Bitcoin, because
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm happy that you see it that way. You know, like I, again, I've felt crazy for both declaring it, but also my feelings about it, but that is what it's about. It comes down to a choice that, and it's really interesting essentially with capitalism and money becoming the religion of modernity. And it's interesting that that's also led us to this place of such like a deep and kind of putrid nihilism that like we think existence actually is worthless and not worth living. That through reintroducing this choice about what money is and how it functions in our world is really powerful, because, you know, when I say I'm a Bitcoiner or you're a Bitcoiner, it's not just a signal that this is the money that we want to use, but it's also that we want to participate in a system of fairness, that we want to utilize a money that has no basis or backing that is tethered to violence or the state or how that functions. And that we also believe in the protections that cryptography offers us. And to me, that change in mindset is very similar to the sort of shift that we saw around what Christianity was able to bring to the world. Not, you know, again, not trying to emphasize the religious point, but more of the actual change of thought and what should be afforded to one another. And to me, because of, you know, it's really important for me to try to tell people, look, like the sort of crimes that the state commits is so much larger and horrific, frankly, than anything that individual men can do. I think it's really important that we utilize the power of the purse and the capacity of making sure that they can't just print money up freely to go do what they want. You know, and like, I think that this is going to be a very long process, but I think as more people choose to join us, it becomes easier and easier, you know? And to me, like, when I got started, like there's probably only a handful of people in the state that were, you know, using this. And like, I didn't even like meet another Bitcoiner in person until I started going into Coinbase. So now that we're seeing like more and more people joining this and starting to understand it and see the vision, I feel more confident than I ever have, you know, not to mention just the macroeconomic landscape. Cause like that seems to be what's getting more people's heads to turn now. But the fact is that, there's a very different world that we can have it doesn't look terribly different from the one that we're in, but it has a lot more peace and fairness about it because of the way that money works, you know? And as the price of Bitcoin goes up more and more and more, you know, like I expect in the next decade, I expect for Bitcoin to become worth more than $1 million per coin, not because Bitcoin necessarily captures all of that value, but because of the way that the state's going to continue to print money and debase it. You know, like, I don't think it'll be very long here before we start seeing $20 gallons of milk and $10 cartons of eggs at the store. Again, I hope I'm wrong about these things, but as Americans, we seem to have this idea that there is some sort of economic exceptionalism that we have that won't have us face the atrocities that they saw in Venezuela or in Argentina or in Zimbabwe, where when governments do start printing money in reckless ways to try to cover their budget shortfalls and other things, it wreaks absolute havoc on the middle class. And after a year like this, I don't think the middle class has a lot more left to give.
Yeah, it's extremely brutal. We have people entering into retirement, like my dad, for instance, is coming into his retirement at some point. And there's, you know, a lot of these guys, they just have their nest egg resting in their 401k, just locked into the stock market. And it's really concerning. Like, this is like their storage of their life's work, their time and energy, day in, day out for 40 years. Like, these guys work their ass off to store this wealth. And all of a sudden, they have to look at what's going on and try to make these decisions. Like, do I take this out of this thing? Do I take my losses? And they have to become investors in order to just preserve what they've made. What would you say to someone in that position, like where they've stored up a certain amount of money in their 401k, and they're just wondering like what's next? Like, is the stock market safe? Are things going to change to the point where I need to be concerned about even having access to this?
You know, I can't give people answers for that, but I can say, Right. Why don't you look at history? You know, what have we seen in history? What happened after the 1929 stock market crash? You know, what, and not just what's happened in the United States, but what's happened in places like Afghanistan after the Soviets invaded? You know, what happened to the stock markets in Europe after World War I and World War II started? You know, like, these are really important questions, because I think most people have been forced to become investors because of how their nest egg is. And I think that there are inherent risks that are outside and beyond the purview of their control with that. With that being said, the same thing can be said for Bitcoin, but the difference is that all of the other exogenous effects that pour onto it are minimized much more. What you have to worry about with Bitcoin is maybe like a mining death spiral, which we've never seen before, but it is possible. Or maybe there's...
What is a mining death spiral? Like all of a sudden all miners start to shut down, or...
Yeah, and that, but because the difficulty drops, it keeps dropping. We've never seen it. It's just been kind of an intellectual exercise. I don't believe it'll happen because markets are pretty efficient. You know, but the other thing that I can say is, look, we've seen the way that Bitcoin's chugged along for 10 years, and not only has it been successful, but it's been resoundingly successful. I expect that to continue. You know, and also, like, this is one of the reasons that I never became a financial advisor around this. I feel a lot of apprehension about telling people directly how to invest their money and what to do with it. And I frankly think it's fundamentally criminal that other people do, because I think at the end of the day, if you... You know, like, if you have so much confidence to believe that you can call how these things function and you want to play with other people's money to do it, I don't know. There's something slimy about the whole thing to me. So I've always advised people to say, look, learn as much as you possibly can about these things. Another thing about Bitcoin is you don't have to go all in right away. You know, like, maybe buy a little and be curious about it. Learn more about it. Encourage yourself to do these things. Because, yeah, this is a huge area of all sorts of different fields kind of merging together that it's important for people to learn about. And to me, what I'd say is, look, if you're worried about that future where the government does lock you out of your own 401k or of, you know, maybe coronavirus doubling down this winter and destroying the stock market, whatever, you should really consider, is this where I want my money to be? You know, maybe gold would be a better idea. Well, what's the problem with gold? It can be physically stolen, and, you know, you have to secure it in a way that can't have people show up with guns to take it from you. What does Bitcoin offer over these things? Oh, okay, if I secure it in this way with multi-sig or other ways, I can actually ensure that it can't be physically extracted from me by government or otherwise. And really looking at all of these things with a critical view is important, you know? And I want to emphasize, you know, I don't think the stock market's going to go away overnight. I don't think that we're going to see hyperinflation by the end of this year. But I do think 5 years out, you know, we have to ask what is going to happen to all this extra money that's been generated and put into the economy. You know, we also have to look at the situation on a global level of what does it mean to have other countries engaging in this kind of inflationary behavior as well. You know, and also even with the nest egg in the stock market thing, like, do you want your money supporting companies like Facebook, Google, and Apple, you know, amongst, you know, 497 others that maybe they don't do things that align with you ethically, you know? That, and for me, that's one of the reasons that I have all of my money in Bitcoin is not only do I feel the most secure with that, but furthermore, like I'm not interested in owning stock in a bunch of companies that I don't really respect or think are doing really great things in the world. Maybe in a couple specific areas here and there. But for me, a lot of my own practice with Bitcoin, frankly, is an ethical and perhaps even at this point a religious practice.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because we're transitioning into a period where, like, one of the things that I think about a lot is how meaning has been just like drained out of so many aspects of our involvement with the world. People's work, like what they spend so much time doing throughout the day, is generally for most people, and I know for me, for a lot of time was pretty much meaningless, like just doing random behaviors that didn't really connect with my soul at all. And a lot of people feel, you know, the need to fill their lives with this type of behavior in order to pay bills and whatnot. And also, like you said, the stock market, with you have these large conglomerates or large corporations that people don't necessarily ethically align with or think are doing anything that great, but their money is there and they're supporting them financially because they think they're going to survive. Whereas what's fascinating is, like, as more and more people start to take responsibility for their own wealth and have a secure store of value, I just wonder, like, how many more meaningful projects will there be in the world as a result of this? There's this element where in the current system, everything is money is just abundant. Money is just like thrown into these large organizations. It's poured out through welfare, and there's no real bound to it, right? And it's almost like in order for there to be a meaningful thing happening, there needs to be some kind of like bound to your behavior. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think part of what you're talking about, what I would reference is kind of the difference between like a deflationary economy and a fiat economy. Fiat on, right. on the side of the nihilistic aspects of, yeah, like we've created, you know, frankly, in my opinion, a life that isn't worth living. Not to say that, like, we need to go kill ourselves, but it's this empty husk of a life where we can't make any real decisions on our own. We don't have the freedom or liberty just to go out and live a celebratory life if we want. And that's hollowed out the meaning of everything, you know, including the fact that these gigantic mega corporations, you can go work for them, pushing a red and green button for your entire life, making no difference about anything. And that's just what you have to do to be able to provide for yourself. And through the conversion to a fiat economy or to a deflationary economy, the comparison that I would make is that, you know, the small farmer who's, you know, maybe raising vegetables on a rooftop garden and selling it at their local farmer's market, because of the way that he does his savings in a deflationary economy, that money's going to make a much bigger difference. You know, I know a guy through, you know, Bitcoin and my internet friends that he was working at a different Bitcoin company early on. But before that, you know, he had converted in 2012, like he was literally scrubbing toilets and taking that money and converting it into Bitcoin. And because he was doing that work then and saved it for now, his purchasing power has increased, you know, some 50-fold because of that. And to me, that's one of the beautiful things that we get from going back to not just a deflationary economy, but also having money not be this free and readily printed thing, is that the trueness of savings can return to its rightful place where it belongs in our world, you know? And I think the etymology between the word economic savings and the idea of spiritual savings, I don't think is just a happenstance coincidence. I do think there's a relationship with that, because the truth is that today no one can actually just save their money. You must invest your money if you are going to save it, which sort of goes to show its inherent nature of that it's not really that at all. Whereas with Bitcoin, if you're starting to save Bitcoin and you stash that away, that's true savings. That's money that you know will be there in the future. And because of the way that it operates on this economic deflationary schedule, you should have a certain confidence that money is going to be worth more in the future. And I know for myself and my family personally, the way that we understand and look at money has changed very radically because of that. You know, no longer are we participating in this economy where, you know, I have to do something with this $10,000 immediately because it's going to evaporate away in a couple of years. Instead, I can say this, you know, while this is some small amount right now, I can stash this away and grow its purchasing power for myself over time. You know, I think that's a really powerful lesson that we get to learn that really changes a lot of these things about existing in this world that, you know, frankly, looking at it, it's a pretty black abyss out there.
Yeah. It seems to me that there is this like aspect of ingenuity, and people are still out there thinking things and doing things. Like, as dire of the situation is, I'm extremely excited to just be learning more about Bitcoin and seeing the extreme potential that it has.
You know, yeah, I mean, ultimately for what it's done for me, you know, like honest to God truth, it's like, I don't know if I'd even be here if it wasn't for Bitcoin. Because one is that when I discovered Bitcoin, a lot of it was on the back end of the Occupy movement having failed. And I was in a crushing depression from it. You know, and I really thought like, this is it. We like live in this corporate nightmare. We have to put up with the government fucking us in the ass for the rest of our lives. And like, that's it. And I was really hurt by that idea that like, I didn't have agency or power against this whole system. And when I found Bitcoin, I started investigating it more and understanding it more. And then I finally had like my light bulb moment where I really went off with it. You know, I ran with it. And like looking back over the concourse of that, the way that it introduced me to all these people who are now my great friends, the way that it helped change my understanding of these really important topics. But like beyond all that bullshit, like the thing that's the most important is the personalized agency that it gave me and the belief that I could have in myself that not only could I understand this stuff and get a handle on it, but that by me going with my own beliefs and ideals and saying this matters, it aligns with who I want to be and what I believe in, it bloomed into this huge, you know, what is my life now? And like some of that's the monetary aspect, but I'd say much more so is the personal agency. You know, like when we had the last fire evacuation come through here, it was great that I grabbed my go bag and I went. And, you know, there's a real possibility I could come back and my fucking house is going to be burned down and all my stuff.
Yes.
And it was great that in the back of my mind, instead of me just being scared shitless, there was this, if it happens, it's okay. You know, I got the insurance papers and all that stuff, but I got my Bitcoin. And that being able to access that no matter what's happening is really important. You know, in the same way that, like, if I would imagine if I had to flee my home because of political reasons, you know, not that that would necessarily happen here, but, you know, like, when I worked at Coinbase, I knew people that, like, literally they fled from their door out of Venezuela. I'm like, that was it. Wow. And, like, that's why Bitcoin was important to them, was because when they got to the border, instead of them getting shaken down and all their shit taken from them, they had a brain wallet so they could access their Bitcoin on the other side. And that's what kind of gave them the ability to keep going. And so like while stuff looks dark out there, I say like, This piece of technology is really, really bright, and it is really serving and powerful. And to anybody that has doubts or hesitations, I say, take a deeper look, investigate it more, find out what those doubts and hesitations are. And I'd say the most important of all of that is, if you find that you're doubting it because it's too good to be true, that's where you really need to spend the time and energy to dig in more. Because, yeah, I'll be the first to say, yeah, it seems like it's too good to be true, and it's here.
Awesome. I think that's a great place to leave things off. Eric, thank you so much, man. This has been great. I've learned a lot just talking to you, and hopefully we can have many more conversations about this stuff. It's really great.
Yeah, man, you're very welcome. I always appreciate seeing new people get in and trying to get on a hustle.
Thank you guys for listening in. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Eric. It was an absolute pleasure for me to have him on. And I particularly appreciate Eric's openness and vulnerability when he's talking about his own personal journey through Bitcoin. If you guys like the show, feel free to hit the like button. And if you want to support the show, you can do that by subscribing, leaving a review, and sharing it with any of your friends who you think might be interested. Also, if you're thinking about joining us for the Interactive Deep Dive event coming up December 12th through the 13th, you can learn more at interactivedeepdive.com. And until next time, may you live a meaningful life and enjoy your freedom as a sovereign individual.